This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
You're listening to the Helen Farmer podcast with me, Poonam Verma. Today on the chef's table is Chef Kim Kevin from the Luxembourg Pavilion. Ian O'Han from Crush Brands has launched a new platform to help local foodpreneurs. Hind El Oasis is smashing the stereotypes of Arab women at Expo 2020. I also chat to one of my favourite travel blogs who's going off the beaten track. And I chat to the Deputy Prime Minister of Mauritius, who is in Dubai for the first time and will be visiting Expo. And finally, I'll be chatting to the lovely Wonder with Nada. She's got updates on new activities around Dubai, Abu Dhabi and Sharjah.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, if like me, you're more obsessed with the food offerings at Expo than actually standing in the queues for the pavilions, and this is a fact when it comes to me, well, I have another foodie place for you. It's one of the world's smallest countries. Can you guess? It is the Luxembourg Pavilion, and it's one of the very few pavilions at Expo 2020 Dubai with a Michelin-starred chef. His name is Chef Kevin Dadoud, and you will find him serving up his dishes at a restaurant there in the pavilion called Schengen Lounge up until the 31st of March 2022 this year, obviously, because that's Expo 2020. Now, tell me, Chef Kevin, have I just pronounced your name right and the actual lounge?
Yes, well, actually, my name is Kim Kevin, so...
Ah!
I'm always Kim to Kevin, that's a bit of a... But for the rest, it's perfect.
Kim Kevin? Yes, Kim Kevin. Is that an actual name from Luxembourg? That's an unusual name, the surname?
That's a very unusual story for it. It was pretty much because my parents were fighting about my name, and then they decided, okay, we can't decide, let's put them all through.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, your parents. Okay, and the restaurant, is it right? Schengen Lounge?
Schengen Lounge, yes. Sorry.
Okay. Now, I have travelled around Europe many times. I grew up in England, so, Europe was like an hour's flight. We'd get cheap flights and go like every weekend. And I remember I was looking online to go to Luxembourg. Oh, my goodness. It just looked so quaint with all the castles. And I was like, I need to go there. But the flight timing didn't work at the time when I was working. Tell me about Luxembourg. I really do want to go. I love walking around streets of small old towns and everything. First of all, what was it like growing up there?
Well, if you haven't been to Luxembourg yet, you really should go because it's a really beautiful small place.
Yeah.
It's perfect for short holidays, really short trips.
Yeah.
As it's small in size, there's a lot you can do, but it's still small. So, well, growing up there, it was quite nice for me because I grew up in a very rural part of Luxembourg, up in the north.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up on a farm.
Nice.
Or with a farm. And we always used to walk even when I was 6 years old, we used to walk down the street through our little town to get to the bus, to get to school, and always meeting the other children of the town. And so it was, really rural life, really quite interactive with the other people living in the city. And everyone knew each other. It's very, very small.
That's what I was going to say, because it is one of the smallest countries in the world. Did everybody know everybody's business?
Yeah, most of the time, it's even here in Chinatown, it's quite funny because there's a lot of people that come and say, oh, I know your father, I know your mother, I work with your brother. So it's very funny.
Oh, that's nice. I like that community feel. So what's the food scene like generally? Because I don't know anything about Luxembourg food or the dishes.
Well, generally, so traditionally, it's quite a rustic food because we used to, in the traditions, in Luxembourg used to be a lot of farmers in the north or in the south. They used to work in the mine, so it was heavy labor.
Yeah.
So they really needed food to sustain them.
Is that like meat and potatoes kind of thing?
Exactly. Meat, potatoes. So it's really those very heavy dishes. But in recent years, it has started to transform a bit. It became a bit lighter, a bit more modern, with lots of influences from France and Germany, as they are our closest neighbors.
Have you found that in Luxembourg, like many other countries around the world, they're kind of shifting more to that vegan scene?
That one is still developing in Luxembourg. It's not so developed as in other big cities, I would say.
Mm.
So it's still in the infancy in Luxembourg.
Mm-hmm. And have you test tasted any of the restaurants yet here in Dubai? Are you still very busy at Expo that you haven't got out?
Well, I've tasted quite a few, but I've tasted a lot. at Expo itself,
yeah,
but as well if you're in Dubai itself. So, for example, Bokka, which is one of my favorites,
yeah,
which I enjoyed.
Oh, that's amazing. So I want to talk to you about Schengen Lounge.
Oh, well, so you gotta imagine it's Luxembourgish food, but it's a bit reinvented to be a bit more modern, a bit lighter, with some influences from all over the world.
Uh-huh.
Luxembourg is such a multicultural country. You know, it's very small in the heart of Europe, surrounded by big, big countries. So we had a lot of influences coming in. And so it's, you gotta imagine one of our signature dishes is really the Knödeln. So it's a bit like a flour gnocchi, if you so want, like a pasta.
Ah, yeah, the gnocchi, like Italian gnocchi.
Yes. It's a bit in that direction, but it's a bit more rustic, a bit heavier.
Mm.
And traditionally, that one is served with bacon and cream.
Mm-hmm.
But as we decided in the pavilion not to use any pork, we cook it with smoked duck breast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really got the same similarities in flavor, but it's a little more finer.
Mm.
And then we finish it off with a duck shoe, some fresh herbs made with tarragon, some parsley, some chives. So it's very, very aromatic.
Sounds very, very tasty. I was telling everyone before, you know, one of the things, like, we do the show there once a week. I was there yesterday. And I leave the show, and the first thing I do is, shall I go into a pavilion or shall I go to a restaurant? And I go to a restaurant. I just can't help it. I think the food choice is pretty amazing there. So what's the feedback been like from your customers trying this food?
Oh, it's been very, very good. I would even say nearly surprisingly good from locals, from all over the world.
Yeah.
Really, people, they don't really know Luxembourg or Luxembourgish food. So it's a bit of a discovery for everyone coming to the restaurant. And what they discover, they enjoy because it's so special. It's very different to French or German.
So what is your favorite dish on your own menu there?
My favorite dish would be most probably at the moment our lamb dish. So it's a lamb loin that's been roasted classically. Then it's rolled in like a breadcrumb with all kind of different herbs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very green.
Mm-hmm.
And that one we serve with a mushroom and potato waffle.
Mm.
It's a waffle, but it's with mushrooms inside and potato inside.
Nice.
And then we serve it with a mustard jus made with three different mustards. So there's some Dijon mustard, some all-grain mustard, and some pickled mustard seeds. It's
so,
very interesting, very flavorful.
Yeah, you know, every country has their own kind of herbs and plants and, you know, ingredients. Is there something particularly that Luxembourg has that you haven't found here and that you haven't been able to source, so you've changed the menu a bit?
There's a product called Carcase. So it's a cheese, but it's a boiled cheese.
Boiled
and it's
cheese.
Something that's very, very specific to Luxembourg.
Does it come from a sheep, a cow, this cheese?
It's cow's milk,
cow's
but it's cow's milk. It's been boiled for a very long time. So, like mozzarella, it's boiled a little bit.
Yeah.
But this one has really been boiled and boiled and boiled.
So it's very hard.
Yeah, it gets this very hard, gooey consistency. And normally we warm it up and we add some herbs inside so it gets back to a bit more liquidy, like a raclette kind of consistency.
Yeah.
And that was something I couldn't find here, not even something remotely similar. So.
Okay. Yeah, so you have to kind of change it up because it can be difficult. What are your thoughts on Expo? How has the experience been for you and what has it been like to be part of it?
I've been very humbled and very honored to be part of it. So it's an amazing experience. You meet a lot of people from all over the world. Especially I get to taste a lot of food from over the world. I meet a lot of chefs. So it's a very fun and very interesting experience.
What when you, as a chef, go to other restaurants, do those dishes inspire you to create new ideas and new flavors as well?
Yes, definitely. That's actually how I mostly get my ideas from tasting other things and or other flavors, other foods, and that then I incorporate them into my personal cooking.
I know that you also have brought students from the Culinary School of Luxembourg here to help you. So is that as a training ground for them or an opportunity?
A bit of both. So it really was the idea to showcase Luxembourg and Luxembourg's hospitality.
Mm.
And as the culinary school and the hospitality school in Luxembourg is one big part of the country, we really thought it's a great idea for the students to come to Dubai, experience different cultures, experience working with a different team in different conditions. So it's a very, very much learning experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, it really showcases that even the students in Luxembourg have already very lot of experience and a good know-how to serve the customers all over the world.
Yeah. Now, have you ever tried spicy Indian food? Are Luxembourg people into that?
I love it.
You do?
Yes, yes. Most of our students, it's too spicy, but I've been working in Singapore, in Kuala Lumpur, so I've eaten a lot of spicy food already, and I'm a big fan.
So as a chef, are you now settled in Luxembourg, or do you still travel and work or in different restaurants?
I still travel and work a bit. So pretty much like before Expo, I was working in Singapore, in Kuala Lumpur. After Expo, I'm going to go back to Singapore for a while. So
any plans to come here?
Not yet. Never say never.
Now, Chef Kim Kevin, we're going to ask you a few questions, a little bit personal questions, just to find out more about you. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here we go. So, Liz, where were you born? Were you born in Luxembourg?
I'm born in a little city called Etelbruck in the heart of Luxembourg.
I can't even pretend to pronounce that. Say that again.
Etelbruck.
Okay. Right. What is your first foodie memory? What do you remember the most about food when you were little?
The first real memory I've got is peeling potatoes with my mother.
Oh.
But that's a very, very funny story because I was really, really small. I barely could walk. And I was sitting on the kitchen table watching my mother cook.
Yeah.
And she was peeling potatoes. And I saw her and I started making a fuss. And she was like, what's going up? You know, you had food, you just woke up, you are clean, you know, why are you making a fuss? And I started pointing at the knife. So she was like, you want to peel potatoes?
Hang on, how old were you when you were pointing at this knife?
Not even a year old.
Oh, okay.
And so after a lot of back and forth, she gave me first like a peeler, then a blunt knife. And then, you know, after I always threw them in the corner because I wanted the real knife, I wanted the one my mother was using.
I would have given you a plastic knife.
Yeah, she did. She did at first. But, you know, I kept making a fuss and then she got so fed up that she passed me the real knife,
yeah.
The real sharp eating knife.
Oh, no.
And literally the moment where I had it in my hand, I started peeling. My grandmother walked in the kitchen, saw it. Took the knife and started scolding my mother.
But
so that's really the first memory.
Wow, that is crazy. Obviously, that little instinct was in you then, no?
Yeah.
So who actually taught you to cook? How did you actually get into it?
Mostly my mother. So I grew up at home, and you know, my parents, they separated when I was seven,
mm-hmm.
and they were always very busy. I grew up on a farm, so the parents were never there, and always to have time with my mother, I used to help her cook, I used to help bake, I used to help...
You're a good son. You're a really good son.
So after that, I really got to the point where my mother used to work two different jobs to be able to support our family.
Yeah.
And so I used to come home from school and I used to cook because I knew if my mother came home, she would have to cook, she wouldn't have time for me.
Bless you.
She came home, we had dinner, and then she would have time to do the homework with me or play games or something like that. So,
even though you had to cook, did you enjoy it while you were doing it?
I did it because I enjoyed it. I think that was the reason, really. I mean, I'm in a family of four, so I've got two older brothers, one older sister. They all could have cooked, but because I enjoyed it so much, I did it.
So in my family, like, you know, we all would cook together. My dad, my mom, my brother, we were all really good cooks because we got involved and food was everything, especially in Indian families, like a lot of cultures. So what is, when you say you have siblings, did they get into the cooking too?
We had a bit of this. So some days it was my sister cooking. Some days my second oldest brother. My older brother was barely ever cooking because it's really not his thing.
Yeah.
He only got into cooking a few years back, and now he's always like, he's calling me and says, "Oh, I've got some salmon in the fridge. I've got some cream. I've got some shallots. What can I cook?" So I really tell him what to cook on the phone at the moment because he lives alone and he doesn't really know how to cook. So he really teaches himself and exchange with me.
Yeah, you know, I honestly, one of the greatest talents, I think, which especially when it comes, not this is sexist, but with men, I think it's really important, and for women, because a lot of women don't, just having basic cooking skills. I think so many people lack it, especially here in Dubai. You can order anything or you have a cook cooking for you. And I think if you can cook for yourself, you can nourish yourself better. What do you think about that?
Oh, I totally agree. I think it's really one of the basic skills everyone should have.
Yes.
You look back now, I don't know how it was in Dubai, but with the lockdowns and all, like in Luxembourg, where I live in Luxembourg, if you don't know how to cook, you wouldn't have food.
Yeah, same with me in my hometown,
So it's really one of those essential things that you need to know. I mean, the very basic things. No one needs to.
No.
But everyone needs to be able to cook like me because then I would not have a job anymore. But basic cooking.
So what are some of the challenges you faced in your career as a chef?
I had many.
The ones that stand out, maybe, that probably changed you and helped you grow.
I think one of the biggest challenges I had was so pretty much after I finished culinary school, I started working. I first worked in Germany, so I never actually worked full time in Luxembourg until recently. So I started working first in Germany, like in a 2-star Michelin, and it was my first job. So I started at a very low position in the kitchen, on the cold side, and after about 3 weeks to 1 month, the chef of my station, so that was the cold station, he ended up in a fight with my boss.
Oh.
And he left.
Oh, okay.
And he took along all
was
the...
Was he getting hot in the kitchen? Was, you know, the tempers rising?
Yeah, really, like you would see it from the movies, really, really seen like that.
Gordon Ramsay style.
It was quite intense. So pretty much the guy left and he took along all the recipes from the station. And the next day in the morning...
Whoa, really?
And my boss came to see me and he said, well, you know, he left. I'm hardly doubting he comes back. I promote you, you know, chef party now, so you're in charge of this station. Well, you know how to do. And I was like, I don't have the recipes. And he was like, what do you mean you don't have the recipes? So, well, he took all the recipes. We don't have a single recipe left.
Oh, goodness.
And he was like, oh, well, you'll figure it out. And he left.
Wow.
So didn't have the recipes. I just knew by seeing, so I really had to, you know, use the internet to find recipes and ask the other people in the kitchen to, you know, how would you do this? And and I really had to get the things done at a very high level without any recipes or any information.
When you're at home, what kind of food do you cook for yourself? Are you somebody like me that I'll just open the cupboard and the fridge, see what there is, and I'll just kind of mix something together? Because I kind of like doing that rather than sticking to a set kind of recipe. Or do you have very simple food at home because you're always cooking during the day?
I mean, that really depends. I mean, I would say like now when I go home at night, at the moment, my go-to food at the moment is really, I've got the hummus from the supermarket, frozen pasta that I pan fry. But back in Luxembourg, very often it really depends. Sometimes when like my mother invites some friends over, I really make myself a pleasure to cook like a three-course meal, something very special.
Yeah.
If I just know that like my sister comes over for dinner, I make a nice pasta dish or something very rustic that is very simple. It really depends on the day. And as well, something my mother is always surprised about is, like you said, you know, I open the fridge. She said, oh, there's nothing to cook. I open the fridge and I start making a cold meal with all the things that are in the fridge that she would never have used.
That's so what I do. I like that style of cooking I do. I just think it's more creative.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, is there a dish that you feel would be you on a plate if we had to eat it? Would that describe you?
I think there is an option. There's a dish that I really liked a lot and that really showcases a bit this connection that I've got with Asia personally, having worked so long in Asia, which is a lobster, which is just cooked classically in the water, then glazed with butter. And it's served with a classic French lobster bisque infused with yuzu kosho, which is Japanese chili paste.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that, yeah.
And then some pumpkin slices with a bit of vanilla oil. So it's really... It's this mix and match between Asian, Luxembourgish, French, rustic, and yet fine. So I think that's,
Do you have a set way of eating? I mean, it's hard for a chef, to be honest with you. Like, do you have a set meal plan, as in you always have something that you love for breakfast in the morning, for example?
For breakfast, every day I have granola because it's simply easy to eat. It's, you know, it's kind of healthy, it's tasty, it's sweet, you know, it's a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And it's easy, it's fast, so I don't really need to think about it. And for the rest, it really depends. I mean, lunch and dinner, I never plan anything. I some days I don't even have lunch or dinner, so it really depends on the day and on the feelings.
What has been the highlight of your career so far?
Well, I think the absolute highlight of my career was a couple of years back when I gained my Michelin star, my first Michelin star.
Yeah.
I think that for any chef, it's always a highlight because it's something that's still very rare. It's something you work for your whole life. And that was really special, yeah.
And what about, have you ever had a bad review? And has it really, like, cut you down? Made you sad?
Yeah, that was as well in Singapore, actually. Just shortly before we got our star, it was. And it was a review by a very, very well-known Singaporean food blogger, food writer. And the way he wrote the review we all thought it was not really fair how he wrote it, because he was comparing our dishes to something that's very Asian.
Yeah.
And saying that, oh, you know, our dish was inspired by, for example, like a dim sum, but it's not a dim sum. So, yeah, well, it's inspired by, so it doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
And it was a bit unfair, and it really cut us down, but I think we jumped back from it quite fast, and sometimes you don't need to listen to everyone.
So as a Michelin star chef, what is one great tip you would like to give up-and-coming chefs that you've learned along the way?
Oh, I think one great tip is, you know, really go out and learn and see and experience different cultures, different food styles, different cooking styles. I mean, really gather all the information you can get, and then keep what you like and discard what you don't.
Okay, so, go ahead, sorry.
So I used to work, you know, I used to work in Germany, I used to work in France, in England, in Belgium. I had a lot of head chefs and executive chefs that had their way of doing things. So I really looked in the different techniques and flavors that they would combine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while you work there, you do it their way.
Yeah.
And after you leave, you adapt it in the way that you yourself prefer. And I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. If you had to choose one meal, your last meal on Earth, for your last day on Earth, such a sad question, what would you choose?
My mother's quiche lorraine.
It's always the mum or the grandmother's, isn't it? It's always one of those dishes. What's so special about this quiche lorraine? And are you serving it at the Schengen Lounge?
No, this specific dish we're not serving in the Schengen Lounge because it's very French, very classical French. But I think this is just one of those dishes. My whole life has always been... It's been the one dish where I never had to complain about to my mother.
Oh, so you complained.
I mean, there was at the age of 6 or 7, we used to go to the supermarket, and I would tell my mother, "Don't take that fish; take the other one. It's nicer. It's fresher."
Oh, so, bless!
Oh, I already started very, very young, and I was very specific about a lot of things. And this has been the one dish where, up to today, I say my mother's tastes better than mine.
Wow. Well, there's always going to be that, isn't it? You know why I always say it's to do with your mother or your grandmother? It's because it's being cooked with love. It's a different kind of energy being put into that food. That's what I honestly believe.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, Chef Kim Kevin, before I let you go, I found out some fun facts and quite interesting about Luxembourg. Just wanted a little brief conversation with you. I heard that public transport there is free. Is that true?
Yes, entirely free everywhere you go.
That's crazy! Is it the only country that has free public transport?
As far as I know, yes.
Wow.
I'm not sure we're the first, but as far as I know, we're still the only one to do that.
So if public transport is free, why is it that Luxembourgers own the most cars, meaning they have the highest rate of car ownership in the world? Why aren't they using the transport?
I would say because Luxembourg is very diverse. So you have the south of Luxembourg where there's a lot of public transport. There's train, there's tram, there's a lot of good buses, and then you have the north of Luxembourg, which is a bit more remote. So, for example, the little town where I live is like a 15 family town. There is one bus per hour, so it's not very convenient still.
Yeah. That makes sense.
On the other side as well, I mean, cars are not so super expensive in Luxembourg. Petrol is quite cheap for Europe, so a lot of people enjoy as well driving with their car, and you know.
Now you have 17 kilometers long ancient tunnels under the city. Have you been in these tunnels? Did you run around in them when you were a kid?
Yes, they're called the Casemate. Yes.
Are they like very like? Is it something that tourists should actually go and see? What were these tunnels used for, by the way, back in the day?
Well, those tunnels were part of the fortification of Luxembourg. So back in the 1600s, 1700s, Luxembourg as a city, because back then it was not a country yet, it was really the heart of Europe. And every big country wanted to have Luxembourg because it was such a fortress city that really was on all of the crossroads of the whole of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really, really well-fortified city. And those tunnels were part of that fortification.
Yeah. Now, I mean, guys, you need to really go on Google and check out Luxembourg. It's just stunning. And the thing that surprises me the most is you only have 2 universities, but you have 100 castles. I mean, you got your priorities right there, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, forget the education, kids. Let's go for a castle.
I think the castle is part of the education. It's the history of your country is always part of your education. So
no,
we have a bit more history to learn about than other countries.
No, visually,
the square kilometers that we've got.
No, visually, it's so stunning. Honestly, I've been looking at the castles, doing my research. I was like, yeah, it's fine. You're next to Germany. You're next to France. If you want to go to university, you can go somewhere else. If there's only two to choose from, it's fine. Anyway.
University is one of the best in the world as well.
So it is?
It's a small one, but it's a very good one.
Wow.
As far as I know it.
Okay. Well, Chef, thank you for spending so much time with me. I know you're a busy man. And so I'm thinking about coming to your restaurant next week. Will you be there? Are you there every day?
I'm not there every day. I'm normally off Tuesdays and Wednesdays. But even then, I'm very often there on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So the chances of me being there are quite high.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure. And I wish you all the best. And enjoy your time here in Dubai.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, if you're baking your own bread at home or even making jam and you sometimes give it to the neighbours, and then sometimes you think, I'd really, really like to get my brand out there, maybe turn it into a little business, well, my next guest may be able to help you. Ian O'Han is the founder and CEO of Crush Brands, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show, Ian. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Now, you have launched a new platform to help local foodpreneurs. But before we get into that, first tell me a little bit about yourself, how you got into the foodie industry, and about your company, Crush.
Okay, so I started, I'm Canadian by background. I've been in the UAE for over 22 years. Started my career in the hospitality sector, so I have a hospitality degree. Ended up in sort of finance and consulting, all related to hospitality and real estate in the early part of my career. Moved to Dubai, did that here. And then when I sold my last company, I decided to get back into food and beverage and particularly operations. And that's how I sort of got going again in the operating side of the business.
So what does Crush actually do? What kind of services does it offer?
Well, so Crush Brands is the mother company, and it's sort of evolved over time from operating Freedom Pizza, which was really its origin. And then, but Crush also, we have our own technology platform. So we do all of our own tech for our marketplaces and our back end and everything. And we also do our own delivery. So we have everything that we do in-house. And Crush does all of these three things in concert. The platform that we built and the ecosystem that we built, it really started to serve ourselves. And what we've realized is that there's an opportunity to help others, and particularly local foodpreneurs in the industry.
Okay, so now this new thing that you've launched, the platform is called Locale. So tell us about that. What is it that will help local foodpreneurs, and do you help them with everything, from getting people to understand what their food is, marketing, or is it just a place where they can get the food and get it delivered?
So it's all of the above. And so what we're looking to do is Locale is basically a highly curated marketplace that we're using to say, let's say every Locale has 15 great brands that are foodpreneur led. So it's important that the foodpreneurs are out front on the platform. It's only 10 to 15 really cool brands in one place. We don't want to have thousands of brands. We don't see the point of it. And particularly in a day and age when, and you go on the aggregator platforms, I don't recognize any, very few of the names there.
Yeah.
So these will be real people with real brands in a highly curated marketplace where we're not competing them against each other, but we're rather using them to create complementary products for the customer and the stories. And their stories of the foodpreneurs is very important. But what we're doing for them is we're basically doing everything for them. So we're aligning our interests completely with the foodpreneur. We become their equity partners. We provide them, we pay for all of the equipment. We provide them with all the services that we provide to ourselves, finance, accounting, supply chain, et cetera, et cetera. So we make sure we provide them with all of those things, you know, and we treat them as our own. And that's why it's important that we're true partners with the people on our platform. Mm-hmm. And of course, we provide them with our proprietary professional delivery drivers, our staff, our team, and of course, our technology in the marketplace. So we basically treat the brands as our own. And that's why we're taking equity positions in these brands. And we become their true partners, and we align our top line and our bottom line. So we're not trying to make money on our technology. We're not trying to make money on our delivery. These are tools we've developed for ourselves, which we can now share with our partners. We want to make money on food. You know, unlike the industry today that's dominated now or disrupted by third-party delivery, where, you know, it's really an unfair balance. They don't make money themselves, even at their enormous scale. Mm. The merchants are paying through the nose 20-30%, which is, you know, and they don't have contact with their customers. So we're trying to restore that relationship between a foodpreneur, the customer, and also making sure that our employees are taken proper care of as well. So all of our drivers work for us. We don't outsource them and things like that. So it's trying to restore those bonds.
Yeah.
And by removing all of the extra fees, the extraneous fees of all these other people trying to make money from this value chain, we're actually a profitable business today. And we want to help foodpreneurs grow their businesses and do it with profit.
Now, I know you mentioned, you know, you're particular with who you partner with. What is it that you look for? Do let's say, for example, I have a really good friend and she cooks and bakes some of the best sourdough bread I've ever tasted. But she does it from home and she gives it to us and friends and everything. She wants to create a business out of it. Would she be able to approach someone like you, or do you actually find and source the brands that you like?
It's a bit of both. What we're looking for, obviously somebody who has a great product, the product has to be great. We want a partner that is fanatical about customers and customer service. You know, that's super important, that they're the ones driving the business and they're the ones, working with their customers and cultivating that business. We like businesses that have a purpose, that are mission oriented, you know, so they have a greater good, whether it's health, other sort of interesting other benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most important thing in business is obviously someone who has drive and determination. So just, you know, incredible persistence and drive to succeed. That's what we're looking for in a partner. And whether it's somebody that we identify or people that come to us, we'd love for people to come to us, and we'll have chats about how we can add value together. And if we can't be better off together, then we shouldn't do something together. We might work together in other ways. But the idea is that, you know, 1 + 1 could equal 5 or 10 if we get the right partners, and we're quite selective about the partners that we work with.
Okay. And did you find during the past 2 years, because of everybody, you know, the pandemic, people slowed down a bit, a lot of local foodpreneurs were sprouting up because they were cooking more at home or trying a new business or trying something different?
100%. And in fact, the first two deals that we've done were, we'll call them COVID startups.
Yeah.
So one was Viking Baggery, which is, I think everybody knows who they are now. It's probably the best baguette in the world that I've ever had. And I've been on the planet a long time. They're absolutely incredible. And the foodpreneurs are so passionate about what they're doing. Mr. and Mrs. Viking and the team, Magnus Eriksson. So we've been working with them very closely. And that's been a really fruitful relationship. And we've just actually launched it on the Locale platform. So if you want the best bread in town, go to locale.ae. And we've set it up so we actually do the bread is basically baked on demand and delivered within 2 hours. So it's fresh bread always. So that's a really great business. And that was very much a COVID startup. So Magnus was always wanted to have bread. And you can hear his story on Locale a little bit from his own words. But he grew up in Sweden, having bread every day, and his father used to bring him a different type of bread, and he wanted baguettes. So this was sort of his he started baking baguettes during COVID, and his neighbors loved it.
Amazing.
And it really is a truly amazing product. So that's one startup. Jetlag Chef is another one. Again, similar. Eliza was worked with Emirates Airlines.
Yeah.
Started to make healthier meals for her herself and her husband, so they could eat, you know, healthy meals together. And then it just sort of exploded, and that business, you know, both of those businesses are thriving now. But our partners don't have to be startups as such, but we really like, I think we add the most value to people who have this type of passion and, you know, at that stage of development.
So you mentioned some of the brands, you know, you got the Freedom Pizza, the baking, the baguettes with Viking, Jet Lag Chef. If there's somebody out there and they're a foodie entrepreneur and they're trying to get it off, is there a particular cuisine that you're looking for to partner with that you'd like to put a shout out to?
It's pretty much anything, you know, so anything that we don't have that's kind of cool. I wouldn't want to put a bracket or, you know, we're not looking for anything in particular, but, you know, but the things I talked about, we want a great product. We want great foodpreneurs, you know, driven people. And what we are careful about is we're not competing people on our platform. So we don't want to have, you know, we want to have complementary, you know, highly curated menu sets, you know, in each locale. So that customers aren't, you know, we're not competing, you know, one product against another. The idea is to create this highly complementary set of offerings that is, you know, is great value to the customer.
I'm assuming you're a big foodie yourself, right?
I eat way more than I should, more often than I should.
I suppose in your job, you have to test taste a lot of things before you say yes. So what are some
100%.
What are some of your favorite brands, like the brands that you work with? I mean, obviously, they're going to be your favorite because you've chosen to partner with them. Tell me about some of them.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at our own brands, and that's how, you know, we sort of evolved, you know, from Freedom Pizza was the first major brand, which a lot of people know, healthier pizza. We acquired a company called Salad Jar, in 2019, which makes amazing salads and things like that. So that's an amazing product as well. We also have another brand called Coco Yogo, which is an all-vegan brand, which, you know, produces really, really excellent products, dessert. And, you know, it's 100% vegan, raw, and gluten-free. We also developed another concept called Wildflower, which is very healthy poke, very healthy sides, but really amazing high-quality ingredients. We've talked about Viking Bagri, which is the best baguette in town, certainly, and probably beyond. We've also done, we're doing supply deals now for companies like Nightjar Coffee as well, which a lot of people know. We've also launched Hero Donuts as well, and we'll be doing more with them. You know, and we've got a whole bunch of new brands that and new chefs that we're working with now, and I'll keep you in suspense about some of them. But you know, this is really about having fun and creating really, really cool concepts, really high quality food, high quality ingredients, and just putting those all in one place, you know, and making it easy for our customers to choose one or all. And I think what's cool about the Locale platform is you can choose one item from every single brand on our on our menu and order it at the same time.
Oh, that's amazing. That's actually really interesting, and that's quite unique.
Yeah, and I think that, and you know, because we're working very closely with all of them, it's very easy to do that. And still, you know, we focus on, you know, having a 23-minute delivery time, you know, making sure that things are packaged properly, hot food goes in hot bags, cold food goes in cold bags. You know, this is, you know, this is what we're good at, and we make sure that we have a high-quality delivery so that the product is as good when it leaves the, you know, when it arrives at the customer's door as it was when it left the kitchen.
You mentioned a lot of healthy and vegan. I know vegan is growing tremendously. Are you really particular about partnering with healthy foods?
It has to be, what we're really focused on is high quality ingredients. So, you know, like you could argue that, so Freedom Pizza, for example, you can argue pizza isn't good for you, but you know, but Freedom Pizza has multi-grain dough. Yeah. It has, you know, 100% mozzarella from, you know, from farms in the UK. Mm-hmm. It has organic ingredients. So it's really, you know, we still like to have our food, but this is really about the quality of the ingredients that matter.
Well, which out of all the brands, which food are you going to send me today so I can test taste them too?
I think we should send you some baguettes, certainly, since we just launched them.
Yeah, you keep going on about it. I really need to do this now and try the baguettes.
And I'd like to send you some salad jars as well because they're amazing products. Even some Wildflower. There isn't one thing on our menu that we're not proud of or I wouldn't be happy to send you. So we can. We should send you a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, you look, please do. My stomach is very wide open for anything. But if people want to order then or go on the platform, where can they go onto it?
So if people, it's very simple. Just go to Locale, LOCALE.AE, Locale.AE. That's the web platform. And you'll see it's a really clean platform. It's focused on food, high-quality images of the food. And, you know, there's no ratings. There's no advertising. None of that garbage, if you excuse me. This is about, you know, food, really good food. You know, our tagline is good food matters, good people matter, and good ideas matter. And so this is, so if they go to that platform, and they can also download the app, which is super cool and super convenient as well.
All right. Ian O'Han, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I cannot wait for my baguettes.
We will send them post-haste. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, our next guest is talking about trying to change stereotypes of Arab women and Muslim women across the world. And no matter what culture or country you're from, we do all have stereotypes that people place on others. And the Women's Pavilion at Expo 2020 have been bringing this to light. They recently had an event called Super Sheroes, which I love, and it's about how Arab and Muslim women use media to shatter stereotypes. Now, with me now is Hind Alawais, the Senior Vice President of International Participants Department. It's a long one, at Expo 2020 at Dubai. Hello, Hind. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Such a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. I love the name Super Sheroes. So tell me, why did you do this event? What was the reasoning behind it?
So I think for a long time, women in general, as you said, all over the world are not remembered for the amazing contributions that they have made, for the progress that they have contributed to advancing our world. And women are very often relegated or forgotten or erased out of history books. And through the Women's Pavilion, what we want to do is create a new perspective, remind the world that women have always played a role, whether in politics, whether in caring for people and planets, whether in innovation, science, medicine, space exploration. We want to tell stories of women who have made amazing discoveries, inventions, and have been very centrally part of advancing the conversation, advancing our world in sense. Now, when it comes to women, Muslim women in particular, and especially in recent times, I think we are many times looked at as, not strong, or, people typecast us in a certain way. And through this event that we had yesterday, we wanted to invite women who have huge voices in mass media, whether it's in social media, whether it's in regular traditional media such as TV, or whether it's in film or TV series, to tell different stories of what women in this region look like, what amazing contributions they are making, how they are shattering stereotypes through the work that they are doing. And that's exactly what the conversation was about yesterday.
Okay. So growing up, being Indian myself, we also had our own stereotypes back in the day, being a female as to, you know, what you should do, when you should get married, what kind of job you should do, staying at home, whatever. I broke every stereotype as possible, not because I just wanted to. I was a rebel. I just followed my passion. Fortunately, I had my parents who supported me, but I didn't always fit in that box, which is created by society. So for you, what have you seen growing up when it comes to the kind of stereotypes that the rest of the world place on Arab and Muslim women?
I think I am very fortunate that I am a national of the United Arab Emirates. We are living in a country with a leadership that has a vision to make women equal partners. Mm-hmm. We are very lucky to be in a country with a leadership that constantly promotes women's leadership, constantly promotes women's advancement in all sectors. And what I love to tell the story I love to tell most is to people who look at me and say, oh, but, you know, how is it in the UAE? And I tell them, you know, in our cabinet, in the Federal National Council, we have 50-50 representation. So that's our parliament. We have 9 ministers at the highest political representation. We have ambassadors, women ambassadors all over the world, whether it's at the United Nations, Paris, in many other places. And
but Hind, let me ask you this question. Empowering the women and seeing all these women do well, I totally applaud that. But are you noticing a change from the men also appreciating that and respecting that?
Absolutely. Good. You know, when I started my career 15 years ago, over 15 years ago, I had to, you know, go to the men in my family and sort of make my case of why I was wanting to take that path. Mm. And now the men in my family are cheering me on and standing behind me and are so proud. You know, whenever there's a newspaper article, they cut it out and they'll take pictures of it and send it to me and collect it. And supporting the younger generation of women. So definitely there has been a shift in the mindset. And that also goes back to the narrative that our leadership has been espousing and putting forward, that we cannot build this country alone. We need everybody's participation, and women are a part of that.
So, Hind, let's talk about the younger generation. I'm just going to give you one comparison, okay? So my niece, she's now 14, 15, going on 30. She is totally different to how I grew up. She's very blunt. She knows exactly what she wants and what she doesn't want, as though she doesn't even need us guiding her. Do you find a lot of the young Arab female girls literally have that attitude? They're a lot more confident in what they want to do and don't have thinking too much about what we should be doing?
Absolutely. I think that the younger generation doesn't feel the burden of having to be to carry feminism or the fight for gender equality and women's empowerment forward. And I think it's great. They feel empowered. They feel like they have agency, and they feel that they can do anything that they want. And of course, this is due to all the efforts that have been made before them, generations before. The efforts of people who led the way, women who led the way to allow for this younger generation to feel empowered today. For example, take the UAE. My grandmother's generation, or, you know, just the generation before me, my mother, was a very different, had a very different experience. But when you look at what the UAE did, for example, Her Highness Sheikha Fatima, the mother of the UAE, who decided long time ago with the establishment of this country that the priority was to be on education and actually educated all of the women. So you have, you know, generations now of women who are educated. The younger ones feel that this is normal. Right?
Yeah.
It's something that was given to them, and it's great. But we mustn't forget the efforts, the intentions, and the amazing work that was done by the elders before us, by the women before us, who saw the vision and who worked to bring us all of these opportunities.
So let's talk about the role that mass media has had. You know, each country has a different approach when it comes to telling a story. So the UK, where I grew up, may have portrayed Arab women in one light compared to, say, the UAE. So how has media, and especially social media now, played and is still playing a part in shaping global views and the understanding of the Arab Muslim woman?
This was actually a part of the discussion that we had yesterday. And I just want to tell all of your listeners that, you know, we have really exciting programming at the Women's Pavilion. Do come check us out. Be part of the conversations that we host over there. You should come yourself. And
I will.
We have lots of exciting topics that we will be looking into. So next week, for example, we are looking at the SDGs, Global Goals, the UN agenda. And we are, you know, our point of view is that when you empower women, you empower society. And SDG 5, which is all about that, is the mother of all SDGs.
So,
but anyway,
sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say, what was the feedback like from this event? Like, what did kind of, you know, opinions did people, the women especially, come back with?
Yeah. So, you know, the discussion that we had touched on many things. And one of the things that I'm extremely proud of is that Arab women, Muslim women are taking their space in social media. They are taking up space in TV and film, and they are putting their views forward.
Mm.
So that tremendously opens up the space. And social media specifically, there's a lot of power in social media because there's no limit to who you reach. And what you know, it's totally open, and there's a huge reach that you have when you you know, you have a massive following.
Yeah,
and in a sense,
yeah. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead. So, if people want to get involved or come to more, do they have to come to the Women's Pavilion? Will there be more events like this?
Yes, there's going to be, we have events all the time. We have a series called Visions and Journeys where we invite high-level leaders, people with a huge voice, to come and share what their vision is for the future to create equality, what their journey has been in overcoming discrimination, in overcoming obstacles.
Mm.
We've had amazing speakers. So I encourage you to check out the Expo website. We have all our programming there. We have this amazing program called People and Planet, where we also tackle a wide array of issues. At the Women's Pavilion, of course, we focus on gender equality and women's empowerment. And like I said, we're constantly hosting events.
Okay, so I still have yet to visit the Women's Pavilion, so I need to make sure that I pass by. But Hind, thank you so much for joining me today, and we'll have to get you on again for some more events that you have.
Absolutely, and please do visit us. It's a great space.
I know. I think it's a 6-minute walk from my studio. I'm just being lazy. I seem to divert and go into a restaurant. This is my issue. But definitely, I will be there, Hind. Thank you so much for that.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Live your best life
on Dubai i 103.8.
Now, I've always been a very, very big traveler, and I love exploring and having adventures. But then COVID came along and stopped most of us in our tracks. But I did come across a great travel blog a few months ago on Instagram called Off the Beaten Track UAE. And the founder, Natalie, is with me now. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, Poonam. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I love your page because you do a lot of staycations and hidden gems and secret places, which I absolutely love. I love going off the whole tourist map that everybody has. How did this blog first start on Instagram?
Yeah, so it actually started a little bit longer than a year ago. So actually in the middle of COVID, as you say, we are also a family who loves traveling, who loves exploring, who loves to, we seldom will book a nice beach holiday and lay on a sun lounger. That's not us. We like to explore, see new cultures, be in nature. And that's the one thing we always missed here. It's like nature and being outdoors. And so we always had the opportunity to travel twice a year. So once we usually go back to South Africa, and then we do a big summer holiday somewhere. And then COVID came and it all, you know, it all was gone. So we were a bit stuck in the UAE. So we're like, trying to do stuff here, trying to go to the mangroves and try to do a little trip here. You go to Ras Al Khaimah. And then I was looking for more ideas. You know, what can we do? We couldn't travel. We were stuck. And then I was looking online, and I didn't really find what I was looking for. You know, I found a Facebook group that was focused on camping or a Facebook group that was focused on hiking. But I didn't find, you know, a broader thing where you can also put, you know, a little farm vacation or a little secret beach where you were all alone or where it was quiet, or a little quirky little restaurant that you saw along the road trip, or, you know, a sunrise picnic spot, or, you know, name it. You know, there's an art exhibition or all the things that are not touristic. So, because after living here for a while, you know, the brunches and the malls, it's all great, it's all lovely, but you kind of look for real experiences.
Yes.
Again, where you are grounded, where you are in nature, where you're outside, where, you know. And that's when I started. I initially started with a Facebook group, which has the same name of the Beaten Track, because I wanted to I was a little bit selfish. I wanted to get some ideas from other people. And I wanted to create a platform where other people can post their trips. And I don't know, I think it was maybe COVID, but there was such a huge demand for this group because it grew. I don't know, you're on the group, so you know. So, but it grew so much. So many people were interested in that. And I think COVID made us do that. But I think it's in general. I think people are looking for more real things to do, because sometimes you hear, if you live in Dubai and you hear other people say, you say, oh, everything is expensive, everything is superficial. But it's not, you know. Yeah, there are a lot of activities that are free, that are cheap, that are real, you know. But you need to get out there, and you need to look for it, you know. And I think this group, my Instagram and the group, provides a kind of platform where people can share and people can do these trips. And I think it's great, you know. And we've grown, so apparently there was a big demand for this. So
yeah, no, I mean, I love your page. It has grown tremendously. You must be so proud. Yeah. And I think one really thing good about you is that you actually put a lot of facts underneath, whether it's prices, location, or information. And that's great, because sometimes people, you'll see pretty pictures, they don't even tag the place, and I'm like, where is this place?
Yeah.
And for me,
yeah,
it is an informative platform, which is really important. But I also discovered just yesterday you've created, which I love the name, off the Eaton Track, UAE.
Yeah, this is very new, because I think not all restaurants belong in off the Beaten Track, because they're not all. But I decided, you know, let's start one just only for the restaurants. But that is very new. So
yeah, but you know what's great about it? I was looking at it yesterday, and you discovered a new restaurant that is 2 minutes walk from my house. And I'm like, how did I not know this? And she knows this. So you know what I mean? I mean, I really do love your platform. Everybody, you need to check it out. It's off the beaten track _UAE. And it shows all these little secret hidden gems, cafes, hiking tours, whatever you want, which you won't find in an average, you know, tourist brochure or online. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us. Do check her page out. It's off the beaten track _UAE. If you want some great ideas for secret gems, quirky cafes, places to go away that you will not find in a normal tourist brochure.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai i103.8.
So I am honoured to have on the show right now Deputy Prime Minister of Mauritius, Minister of Tourism, it's Honourable Louis Stephen Obigadu. Welcome to the show and welcome to Dubai. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm doing great. Delighted to be in Dubai, and thank you very much for having me on your show and giving me the opportunity to speak directly to your Emirati listeners.
Is this your first time to Dubai?
First time indeed. I've often travelled through Dubai on transit, but the Expo 2020 provides us with a golden opportunity to be here and to meet with locals and the population here, and to speak about Mauritius and to invite residents here of Dubai and Emirates in general to come and visit.
Now let's talk about visiting Mauritius, because one of my oldest friends is originally from Flick and Flack, and I've still never been to Mauritius, and she talks about
what a shame.
Yeah, so first tell me, why are you here? Because I know you want to talk about and promote the travel and the tourism. I mean, a lot of people have been to Mauritius from this region. How important is it?
Well, we have a Mauritius pavilion at the Expo 2020, and I'd like to invite all the listeners to visit, and they can learn a lot about our country. Mauritius is a high-end tourism destination with a reputation since long that has attracted tourists from around the world. Now, we would like to open up further to the inhabitants of Dubai and the Emirates to come and visit. We have been open for a number of months now after having ensured that our population is very highly vaccinated. We've now reached a stage where 90% of adults in Mauritius are actually vaccinated, our hotel staff, our airports, and our transport facilities from airport to hotels are staffed by fully vaccinated personnel, which makes us a relatively safe destination for tourists. So we are open, and there's no going back on that, and we would be delighted to welcome you all to Mauritius.
So let's talk about when COVID first hit. How much of an impact did it have on Mauritius, basically, and the people there?
Well, very much like the UAE, we're an open economy with investor-friendly regulations, with many, many tourists visiting every year. And obviously, we took a hit from COVID. But as I say, we have one main island and a number of minor islands. It was easier for us to close the borders for as long as it was necessary and fully equip ourselves to face up to COVID and safely welcome visitors and travelers, which is what we've been doing now for a number of months. And the great thing is that from Dubai, there is a daily flight at the present time. There were more than a daily flight in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody boards the plane, travels overnight, has a good rest, and is in Mauritius the next day to enjoy the country. And I believe we have a lot to offer. It's not just the sun, sea, and sand that has made our reputation in the past, but beyond that, it's a land of cultural diversity where peoples, you know, from Asia and Africa and Europe have all come to learn to live together, and together have weaved a rich tapestry of interculturalism. So we have a lot to offer as a cultural destination. The food, the dress, the attire, you'll find in any village in Mauritius, a mosque coexisting with Christian churches and a Hindu temple. So it's a destination of cultural tourism as well. And then it's a nature destination, rivers, lakes, mountains, forests, you name it. And that makes for sustainability. We are very keen on being ecologically friendly. So it's a mix, it's a package that should make it a very attractive destination for listeners from Dubai and the Emirates.
Now, you know, I can open a tourist book and see all the best places to go around Mauritius. But as the Deputy Prime Minister of Mauritius, you tell me some of your favourite things to do there, your favourite hangouts that a lot of people on the tourist trail would never find.
Well, obviously, somebody from Dubai who wants a break to see things that are different, mm-hmm. I think will be fascinated by the population of Mauritius, a highly educated population that speaks English, that speaks French, but that also in our schools learns Arabic, Hindi, and Urdu, and very friendly people, very warm hospitality. I think that's the first a striking element when you arrive in Mauritius, the people.
And what about what about the seasons? Like, is it an all-round destination?
It's absolutely an all-round destination. We have mild winters and pleasant summers. Our highly rated seaside resorts are a pleasure throughout the year. But excursions into the hinterland are also possible throughout the year. So we have a very pleasant climate, and I think that is a major source of attractiveness of Mauritius.
And finally, you know, you're going to go and visit Expo. You've yet to see Expo. How important has it been for Mauritius to be part of this?
Crucially important because first and foremost, it's extraordinary that Dubai should have dared to organize such an event in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and to have pulled it off so well, considering the number of participants countrywide and the number of visitors.
Yeah.
So Mauritius had to be part of this. It's an extraordinary and unprecedented international meeting of peoples and cultures, and we're delighted to be here. And I hope this is a springboard, this is a starting point for a much closer relationship between the peoples of Dubai, the UAE, and Mauritius.
Well, I have to say, considering I'm from England, it's been a pleasure talking to someone who's got a better British accent than myself.
Much. You're very generous. but we still need to welcome you in Flic en Flac, did you say?
Absolutely, Flic en Flac. I need to go there, definitely. I've heard it for 20 years. It's about time I visited.
Well, you have an open invitation.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Deputy Prime Minister of Mauritius. It's Honourable Louis Stephen Obigado. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And enjoy Expo.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai i103.8.
So joining me now is the lovely Wonder with Nada, our guide tour of the UAE, especially Dubai extraordinaire. She knows things that none of us know. And the reason I'm saying this is because she's just recently done her tour guide exam. How did that go, Nada?
It went well. It was the renewal exam, so I just kind of finished and so happy to be done with studying.
But I know you had to learn some facts that none of us will ever need to use. Tell me one fact that you learned that you can share with us.
A fact. The number of tiles in the Burj Al Arab swimming pool.
Okay, and how many are there?
There are 10 million.
Whoa, if anyone ever asks me, I will be able to tell them now, thanks to you.
Exactly. Find a way to slip it into conversation. We'll make you look like a true Dubai nerd.
I'll be texting you for all the facts, girl. Listen, let's talk about what new activities are happening around town. We've got Dubai, Abu Dhabi and Sharjah, different locations. So let's start with Dubai.
Sure. So I'm always on the lookout for just new things to do in the UAE. I love to explore my own backyard and just be a tourist, you know, in my own city. So I came across this incredible new find called Aquatech. It's founded by a Dubai-bred expat, Yasser, who's got this passion for everything to do with the beach, fitness, and nutrition. And what he offers is what I could call water therapy. It's a choice of two options. So you get a kayak or stand-up paddleboarding.
Yeah.
And here are the best parts. So number one, the kayaks and the paddleboard are clear, as in transparent.
I like that.
So you actually get to see the gorgeous turquoise water and marine life in the underwater world just below you.
Yeah.
So it's really a great way to see what's under the water without having to get in. The second really incredible thing is you get to pick and choose which beach you want to do this in.
Okay.
So they operate right now in Jumeirah 1, which is right by La Mer, but they also have JBR, Kite Beach, and Palm Jumeirah. But the one by La Mer is the prime spot because of the view that you have there, and that's the Burj Khalifa skyline.
Have you been? Right? Have you used these kayaks yet or paddle boards?
I have. Ooh. I was just there this week. It is beautiful. I'll send you some pictures later. And finally, you actually get to either really just enjoy the tranquil quiet or just go on full party mode because they have these Bluetooth speakers, which you can hook up with your phone.
Do you know, I once took my little kind of iPod or whatever. It was brand new. I bought one just and I put it in a waterproof bag and I went paddleboarding. A wave came and I lost it. And it was the first time I used it. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So that would probably be better. I need someone else to organize the music for me.
Yes. Organize it for you and definitely maybe get a more foolproof Ziploc bag.
No, just don't take music, anything electronic. I'm not going to take it. But listen, where can we find them again? And what's the name of the company?
So Aquatech, you can find them. I mean, I find them on socials, so you can find them there as well. And they have a website that's, I think, up and running, will be there soon. So that's them. The other event I want to tell you about is in Abu Dhabi.
Right.
So this is something called Zamanna, or basically our past. Mm. And what they're doing is they're replaying the 90s at Manarat al-Saadiyat in Abu Dhabi.
The 90s as in the music 90s or the whole decade?
No, so it's I'll tell you what it's about. So it's a new exhibition, and it's featuring UAE-based artists who actually want to remind us of life in Abu Dhabi during the 90s.
Oh.
And they want to take us back to the good old days, right?
Yeah.
So some of the iconic buildings and memories of back then. So you have, like, the street vendors, the neon light dukkan, which is, like, the grocery.
Mm.
So a time where life there kind of moved at a slower pace. I don't know if you've lived here long enough to remember... There was a cinema in Abu Dhabi, the El Dorado Cinema.
I've heard of it. I've never been there.
Yeah, so that was basically Abu Dhabi's first indoor cinema on Electra Street that opened back in 1970. And it was known for its pink and blue neon lights.
Oh.
So they've got this really beautiful tribute to that. Another thing there as well in Abu Dhabi from the past was the volcano fountain. And that was over by the Abu Dhabi Corniche. They built it in the 80s and it actually looked like a volcano. They had these like circular stacked rings and water would cascade down from the top and they would shine these red lights so it looked like there was like lava streaming down.
Mm.
Right, so it was like the happening place for old timers, and they did demolish it at some point. So the artists have recreated it, the volcano, using vintage objects that were once essential to our lives in the 90s. Right.
Nice.
Yeah, really, really cool. Very nice things. Even, you know, recreating what the yellow cabs of Abu Dhabi looked like back when they used to take you all around the capital for just 5 dirhams.
They should have like a thing where you can only come and visit this if you dress like you're back in the 90s too.
Oh my God, yes. What would you be wearing is my question.
I think, oh my goodness. Well, I think it was in the uni or something. So I was always in jeans and these like black boots and just like simple tank tops. That was it. It was simplicity, really, and trying to be kind of a mixture of gothic, kind of funky university style. That was it.
Oh, I need a picture.
I'll send you pictures. So what else do we have?
So that's happening in Abu Dhabi from January 17th. And then the other thing I want to tell you about is now in Sharjah.
Mm-hmm.
And really, like, incredible activity to do would actually be to pay a visit to the Maleha Archaeological Center in Sharjah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can venture deep into the desert there, and you can learn about the first evidence of human life here in the UAE, which was actually discovered on a Jabal Faya in Sharjah. So they give you this evidence. They show you all the artifacts, all the things that they've managed to dig up, that humans, or as we call them, anatomically modern humans, they were actually in the Sharjah Maleha area almost 130,000 years ago. So the guides there really do this fantastic job of explaining, you know, how early humans from this time maybe passed through Arabia from Africa,
yeah,
on their way to South Asia. You can even sign up for these classes, like how to survive the sands in the desert, how to cope with the harsh extremes of the desert with the help of their survival guides. So like basic stuff like how to source water, how to create a solar compass, how to make a fire, right?
That's cool. That sounds cool, all of that.
It is, yeah. They even take you on treks if you're interested to visit Camel Rock and Valley of the Caves.
Yeah.
And after like an adventure-filled day out and maybe a sweaty hike, you can actually refuel at another place which is nearby, which just opened. So they've got these winter pop-ups in the desert. Have you seen those?
No.
No. So they're kind of new, or at least newly opened. So there's one called the 1 Degree Cafe, which is this brilliant space in the middle of nowhere.
Yes,
so
I actually have seen that cafe. I've seen it online, yes.
Yes, so they've got like drinks and desserts, and now they've even started serving food like burgers, hot dogs and fries, live entertainment, even a Bedouin-style camp. So it's really, it's a great way to be taken out of our world and just see the country from a different lookout point, even if it's with a latte in hand, I say.
Not with camel milk. Yeah, everyone's going to go almond milk or oat milk, please.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's just a nice different activity to do. Another also cafe that's opened up in Sharjah, it's called The Uncommon. And it's actually been done up with these mirrors, which reflect the desert surroundings. So It just kind of, I would say, looks gorgeous from certain angles. It looks like it's invisible, like it's not even there.
Yeah.
And it just reflects what's around it. So this was inspired by this home. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's in Joshua Tree in California.
Yes, I know that place, yeah.
Yeah, so that is exactly what I would recommend doing in all of the three Emirates.
Amazing. And finally, you just want to mention something about the Literature Festival, which is a great festival. But what is it that you want to say about it?
Yeah, so it's actually, it's back this February, and what they do is they celebrate the art of writing and the spoken word. And I'll tell you, I love reading, so this is something that is very dear to me. They're bringing in these award-winning authors, leading writers, and just thinkers from all over the world and locally as well. And really, almost every genre is represented, right, including children's literature.
Yeah.
You actually get the chance to meet the authors. You attend these debates and panel discussions. You even get to ask them questions. Imagine that.
I know. Right? Do you know, the last time I went, Malala's dad was there speaking on her behalf. And I also sat with a monk and listened to him.
Wow.
You know, it's all kinds of people. And I think the conversations and listening to people, even if you're not a reader, it's really interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've attended sessions even for authors whose books I've never read.
Yeah.
But just, you know, the topics that they talk about are just really interesting. And the thing is, I mean, it's spread over these 2 weekends from the 3rd to the 13th of February. So you have all this time to just be able to sign up for any of them. And just also find yourself as part of this, like, literary community.
Exactly. Well, what are you up to this weekend? Reading books or going on more tour guides?
More tours. I have a lot of tours lined up for the next few weeks, so I'm just building up and obviously preparing for that now.
Okay, well, I always learn something from you. I don't know how. You've probably got more knowledge about the UAE than anyone at this rate. The fact that you know there's 10 million tiles in the Burj Al Arab pool is, I don't think anyone else knows that, okay?
I can't wait. We'll do a quiz next time. We'll ask some of the listeners what they know about Dubai, some really interesting different facts.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing. Listen, have a lovely weekend and thank you for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Tune in to Afternoons with Helen Farmer every weekday from 2 to 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.